addresses, and some of the major kind of themes and purposes for John's writing of the book. Next time we get together, 2 weeks from tonight, we'll start taking a look at the theology of John. And we'll talk about a very, very important concept, which is the concept of faith and discipleship and what it means to believe. Because this is very central to what John is going to talk about in this gospel. Okay? So let's start with the author of the book. Who is it? How do we know? Because there's nowhere in the book where John identifies himself as the author. Nowhere. Instead, what's the phrase that's used frequently in the gospel to describe the person who is bearing witness of these things? The disciple whom Jesus loved. The disciple who rested on Jesus' breast. Okay? Why would John, if John is the apostle John, is the author, and by the way, there's not unanimous consent among conservative scholars that John, who wrote this, is John the apostle, but it's near unanimous. There are some scholars, like Richard Baucom, as an example, who believe that it was John the Elder, that is, another John who was a prominent member of the early church. He also believes, by the way, that John the Elder wrote the book of Revelation, not John the Apostle. But he's in the overwhelming minority. Why do you think John wouldn't just say, John, me? Why would he use this kind of third-person way of describing himself, the person that Jesus loved? Well, I'll give you some ideas on your notes there. First of all, there is a modesty involved in all of this. John is not trying to draw attention to himself. He's trying to draw attention to whom? Christ. He's going to play a very important role in this gospel, but he doesn't want to push himself forward. He wants to kind of recede into the background as much as he possibly could. Secondly, if somebody said to you, what are popular American names? What are some of the names that would come to mind? John? In America? No. Robert, right? Dan? Mary? And so forth, right? How do you distinguish between one John from another John? One Mary from another Mary? In the first century, John and Mary are two of the most popular names given to children that are born, right? So how does John distinguish all of the Marys? If he's talking about Mary, the mother of Jesus, that's what he says. If he's talking about Mary Magdalene, he often just calls her Mary. Often. But when he's talking about another Mary, he will give a designation. There are a lot of Johns. There's John the Baptist. Peter's dad, his father, was named John. Simon, son of Jonas, that's the Aramaic, John. So in order to distinguish himself from all of the other Johns, he calls himself the disciple whom Jesus loved. There's another reason. The word love is very important to John. Not only in the gospel, but also in 1 John, 2 John, 3 John. Love is a prominent theme in John's letters. So to identify himself as the one whom Jesus loved is to introduce himself into that larger theme. What does it mean to be loved by Jesus? What does it mean to love Christ? How do you prove that you love him? How has he proved that he loves us? So by calling himself the disciple whom Jesus loved, he's not suggesting that he was the only disciple whom Jesus loved. He's saying, I in particular know the love of Jesus and I want to identify myself with him. Furthermore, This positions Jesus as an intimate with Jesus and establishes credibility. Look in John 1 and verse 18. So we're in the prologue here. John 1:18. No one has ever seen God, the only God, who is at the Father's side. Now, if you have an English Standard Version, there is a footnote here after that phrase, at the Father's side. And you look down at the bottom, and it says, or, literally, in the bosom of the Father. Now turn to chapter 13. And look at verse 23. One of his disciples, whom Jesus loved, was reclining at table close to Jesus. Do you see a footnote there? Look at the bottom of the page. Greek says, in the bosom of Jesus. The same construction as what we read in chapter 1. So, what is he saying here? He's saying that the relationship that Jesus had from all eternity with the Father is the same relationship that John has with Jesus. God the Son was close to the Father in his bosom. John, in chapter 13, is reclining at the table with Jesus at the Last Supper, right? And everybody knows this, I think, now, but just a reminder. When you and I come to the table, we sit in a chair, we scoot ourselves up, and we eat. In the ancient world, they didn't have tables and chairs like that, at least in these Jewish homes. Instead, they have a table sitting in the middle, and they have pillows all around the table on the floor, and I can't get up down. I fell this last week, and I am really sore. So imagine that I'm laying down right now with my, let's say I'm right-handed, I am, my left hand here, Jesus is right behind me, and I'm reaching with my right hand and grabbing food and passing it to him and passing it around. I'm reclining against his bosom. That's what chapter 13 is saying. But the verbal form, when he's writing about this in chapter 1, verse 18, says, that's the image I want you to get of Christ in his relationship with God the Father. That kind of shared intimacy is the intimacy that I have with him. So he's providing himself some credibility by saying, I'm an intimate with Jesus. If you'll look at the very end of the book, chapter 21 and verse 24, you can see that credibility is very important. This is the disciple who is bearing witness about these things and who has written these things, and we know that his testimony is true. I haven't made this up, John's saying. This is true. He's trying to establish his credibility with the audience by connecting himself to Jesus. Also, by connecting himself to whom? Peter. Peter. Look at the next part of your notes there. Peter is the principal disciple in the synoptics. What are the synoptics? Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Why are they called the synoptics? Optics means to see. S-Y-N means the same, a synonym, right? Two words that mean the same thing. So synoptics, Matthew, Mark, and Luke are called that because they tend to see the ministry and life of Jesus in the same way. John's very different, as we're going to see in just a moment, okay? Peter is the dominant person in the synoptics. He's the guy that's always speaking. He's the guy that's always leading. He's the guy that's always getting rebuked sometimes. I mean, Peter is the dominant person. He plays a very important role in the early church. And John establishes his own credibility by showing us over and over again throughout this gospel that he's there with Peter. I did not say, by the way, that Peter is the Bishop of Rome, nor the first pope. Just in case you were curious if that's where I was headed with that. Okay? They're together in the upper room. They're together at the empty tomb. Who was faster, Peter or John? Who was braver? Peter, that's exactly right. John gets to the tomb first. He stops. Peter gets to the tomb last, but he goes right in. Typical Peter. They are there at the Sea of Galilee, and of course, at the very end, Jesus gives a prediction of Peter's death. He says to Peter, when you were young, you were led about. Your parents grabbed your hand and took you by the hand and led you wherever they wanted you to go. Same's going to happen to you when you are old. You're going to be led where you do not want to go. And John, writing, says, Jesus said this to predict what kind of death Peter would suffer. When Jesus says this to Peter, what's Peter's response? What about John? And what does Jesus say? Never mind about John. I'm talking to you. I'm talking to you. Do you see me here? That's right. If I will that John lives until I return again, what is that to you? We're not talking about John. We're talking about Peter, right? And John says, a rumor started circulating among the early Christians, and what was that? That John was not going to die. And John says, no, that's not what he meant. That's not what he meant. But there they are, together. So all the way through the gospel, John and Peter are together, and that helps establish John's credibility as a witness to the early church, because Peter has great credibility. There is no doubt among the early fathers, by the way, as to who the author was. The early title of this book, and these titles came later, right? Paul didn't write the letter to the Thessalonians and say across the top, 1 Thessalonians. That came later. And when John writes this gospel, he doesn't write the superscription across the top, the gospel according to St. John. That came later, but the early church believed that it was John. Irenaeus, who was an early church father, he lived between 130 to 200 A.D. Irenaeus said, John, the disciple of the Lord, who leaned back on his breast, published the gospel while he was a resident of Ephesus in Asia. Now, one of the reasons why Irenaeus' words carry weight is because Irenaeus had a spiritual father by the name of Polycarp. Polycarp had a spiritual father by the name of John. So Irenaeus is two spiritual generations removed from John. So if he says John was the author, you can pretty much bank on the fact that John was the author. Okay? All right. Let's talk about the structure of the book. So I've put this up here on the board. I have it there in your notes, but let's just talk about this. So the first chapter of John sets the scene for the rest of the book. So we'll call that the prologue. We'll talk about the prologue in much greater detail next week. Okay, the prologue is very, very important, and we're going to talk about the prologue next week in great detail. The last book of, or the last chapter of the book, kind of brings everything to an end, right? We reach the ultimate pinnacle of the book with the resurrection of Jesus, and then this is the penultimate part of the book, that which is after it, that kind of summarizes everything in chapter 21. These two parts of the book, the prologue and epilogue, we'll say more about it in just a moment. Now, in between the beginning and the end of the book, we have two major sections, okay, and this is very well attested. Virtually everybody agrees to this division. Chapters 2 through 11 are often called the Book of Signs. Okay, so now this is a softball. I'm going to throw it up, and somebody hit it out of the park. Why would chapters 2 through 11 be called the Book of Signs? Please. Oh, thank you, Jan. Jesus was doing signs. That's exactly right. It's called the Book of Signs because this section of the book is about Jesus doing signs. And what are signs? Miracles. Jan, what's the first of the seven miracles? Yes. So he's at the wedding at Cana. They've run out of wine. He says, bring jars of water. They bring jars of water, and he turns the water into wine. That's number one. Okay? What's the last one? It occurs in chapter 10 and 11. The raising of Lazarus, right? So if you were going to plot the trajectory of signs, you know, it's one thing to turn water into wine. It's quite another thing to stand outside a tomb and say, Lazarus, come forth. You're raising the dead, right? So there are seven signs inside this section. More on this section in just a moment. We'll talk about this in a moment, but there is a transition in chapter 12 between the first part of the book and the second part of the book, the second major section, which is often called the Book of Glory or the Book of Exaltation. Again, here's a softball question. Somebody hit it out of the park. Why do you think it's called the Book of Glory? Yes, Marshall. Yes, that's exactly right. It is a book about Jesus' glory. And where do we see that glory? Say it, Faith. On the cross and the resurrection. We often think of glory as associated with the resurrection. This tells us it's also associated with the suffering and shame and embarrassment and cruelty and injustice of the cross. Of the cross. Again, more on that in just a moment. The Book of Signs covers roughly 3 years. The Book of Glory covers just a few days. So, if you were plotting this and making a movie out of it, the first half of the movie is going really quick. This happened, and this happened, and this happened, and this happened, and this happened. And then you get to the second half of the movie, and it really slows down. Think about it this way. 13, 14, 15, 16, and 17 cover 7, 8, 9 hours. Then you get to 19, the crucifixion. Maybe you're talking another 6 to 9 hours. So by the time you get to 13, the plot line is really moving slow. Why do you think that is? This is a little literary analysis here. If you're just, you know anything else about the gospel, this is just a book written by Charles Dickens, and your professor in college, your literature class, said the first half of the book is moving really fast, and then it really slows down. Why does it slow down? What would you say? Bingo. This is where everything has been moving toward. This is what's so important. It's a wonderful thing to turn water into wine and raise a dead guy from the grave. But the gospel is not about what Jesus has done in those signs. The gospel is about what he does here. This is where the weight of the book is all about. Okay. Now, several commentators have made a suggestion, and I think it's good, that these two sections of the gospel tell us something about the ministry of Jesus And there is a correspondence between these two parts of John and the two volumes of Luke. When John tells us about these signs, who's the audience? Who are the signs primarily being done for? They're witnessing to what group of people? The Jews, Israel. In chapter 12, and this is why it's a transition, Gentiles show up, Greeks. Maybe they were Hellenistic Jews. But Greeks show up, getting ready for Passover. So they've migrated to Jerusalem, getting ready, and they've heard about Jesus. And so who do they go to say, could we visit with Jesus? Who do they go to? You remember chapter 12? Philip. Who said that? Okay, that's all right. This is an open book test. So that's what. Now, what's significant about Philip? He's got the Greek name, right? Alexander the Great's father was Philip of Macedon. Macedonia was named for Philip of Macedon. Philippi was one of the major cities in Macedonia, named, of course, for Philip, right? So John sees a significance here, that suddenly, at a feast of the Jews, Greeks are showing up, and they want an audience with Jesus. But what is really significant about this is what Jesus then says. What does he say? My hour has now come. Liz gets 2 stars today. My hour has now come. What is the significance of that? Because in this transition, we are moving from his ministry that has been solely given to Israel to now his saving purposes, which is going to go where? Yeah, to the Gentiles. Book 1, the Book of Signs, is about his ministry to Israel. Book 2 is how he is now going to minister to the new Israel. The way in which Israel is now going to be formed, that will include both Jews and Gentiles alike. Now, Luke has 2 books. Volume 1 and Volume 2, History of the Early Church. Volume 1 is called the Gospel of Luke. Volume 2 is called the Book of Acts, Acts of the Apostles, right? Luke, like the Book of Signs, is all about Jesus' ministry to Israel. Acts, as a follow-up to the Book of Glory, is about the gospel going where? From Jerusalem to Judea to Samaria and then to the uttermost parts of the earth. Now we're going to see in just a moment that in the Book of Signs there are 3 cycles of ministry. And the first cycle of ministry is called the Cana cycle. The reason it's called the Cana cycle is that it starts at Cana, goes to Jerusalem, goes to Samaria, and then back to Cana. Okay? There are 3 prominent people that Jesus encounters in the Cana cycle. There is, first of all, Nicodemus. Nicodemus is whom? What ethnicity is Nicodemus? A Jew. The second person that he encounters in chapter 4 is the Samaritan woman. And then the third that he's going to encounter is the official whose son is dying. Jerusalem, Nicodemus, Samaria, Samaritan woman, and to the uttermost parts of the earth, the official son. John is already previewing in the Book of Signs that this gospel is not for Israel only. It encompasses the Samaritans, and it encompasses the Gentiles. It's a preview, a kind of literary foreshadowing of what's going to come in this book. And just like Luke's second volume, the book of Acts, it is about the move of the gospel out from Jerusalem and Judea to Samaria and to the uttermost parts of the earth. All right, second page. First sheet, turn on the back. All right. We're going to talk about the prologue in detail next week. But here's the point. Go to John 1 again. In the first 18 verses, John is going to say this about Jesus. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. So in some sense, the Word was both with God and God. What does that mean? Well, that has real implications, not only for our Christology, who is Jesus, because the Word, as is going to be clear, is Christ. Why does he call him the Word instead of just saying Jesus? Well, why does he call himself the disciple whom he loves instead of just saying John? He has a reason. Well, more on that in 2 weeks. All right. So he was the Word and was with God, and he was in the beginning with God. Verse 3, all things were made through him, and without him was not anything made that was made. In him was life, and the life was the light of men, and so on and so forth. All right. Verse 14. And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we have seen his glory, glory as of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. Verse 18. No one has ever seen God, the only God, who is at the Father's side. He has made him known. Now, think about that. No one has seen God except God who is at his side. And he's made him known. So what's John saying about Jesus? He's God. And he was with God. And everything that you see was created by him. That is a really bold statement. So John says, to bolster my testimony, so that you believe that I'm speaking the truth, I want to call some witnesses. And the first witness I want to call is whom? John the Baptizer. So beginning in verse 19, he brings John forward and says that John sees Jesus and John testifies to Jesus. In fact, he says, verse 19, this is the testimony of John. Right? So, John, do you swear to tell the whole truth? The truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth? And John stands up and says, I will tell the whole truth. Who was Jesus, John? And so, first of all, we have to establish who John was. Right? So you go through this, and he's being asked by priests and Levites, who are you? I'm not the Christ, he says. I'm not Elijah. I'm just the guy who is preparing the way for the Messiah to come. And then the Messiah shows up at the Jordan River, and John is there, and what does John say about Jesus? Behold, the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world. Right? More on his testimony next week. Then John, the author of the book, says, I want to call some other witnesses. So he then gives the testimony of the early disciples. Beginning in verse 35 through the end of the chapter. I won't go into all of that detail. We'll look at it in more detail next week or 2 weeks from now. But notice verse 49. Here's the final testimony of this section. Nathanael answered him, Rabbi, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel. So right up front, before we even get into the meat of the book, here in the prologue, we already know what the book's about. The book is about Jesus of Nazareth, who was crucified by Pontius Pilate on a Friday in the spring of AD 33, And John is coming forward and saying, let me tell you who he is. He's not who you think he is. He is the very Son of God. And he was witnessed by John the Baptist, and he was witnessed by the early disciples. And the reason why we know this is what John is trying to communicate is because of the way he ends the book. Go to chapter 20. Eight days after Jesus first appeared to the disciples in the upper room, he appears again. Somebody is there who wasn't there 8 days earlier. What's his name? Thomas. Doubting Thomas. So verse 26 of chapter 20. 8 days later, his disciples were inside again, and Thomas was with them. Although the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." Then he turned to Thomas. Because keep in mind, when Thomas showed up and he said, "Look, I am not believing you guys unless I see the nail prints in his hands and the spear print in his side. I'm not believing it." Jesus now shows up and says, "Thomas, I heard what you said." "Well, Lord, you weren't there." "Oh, I was there. I heard what you said." So he says, "Thomas, put your finger in here and see my hands and put your hand and place it in my side. Do not disbelieve, but believe." And Thomas said to him, what? "My Lord and my God." Okay? So the prologue begins with Nathanael saying, "You are the Son of God." And it ends with Thomas saying, "You are the Son of God." So what do you think the book of John's about? That Jesus is the very Son of God. God incarnate. God in human flesh. The God who is here. Okay? Let's talk about the outline. When you get into the book of signs, you get into three cycles. There is the Cana cycle. The reason it's called the Cana cycle is it starts in Cana, the wedding at Cana, turning water into wine. It moves to Jerusalem, where Jesus is going to meet Nicodemus. It moves out to Samaria, where in chapter 4, the Lord is going to meet the Samaritan woman. And then it turns back to Cana, where the Lord meets the official. Okay? So that's the Cana cycle. That's the reason it's called that. So that's chapters 2 through 4. Okay? The second part of the book of signs is known as the festival cycle. Why do you think it's called the festival cycle? What is it? Party time? I hadn't thought of it that way. But yeah, I guess we could call it that. Why is it called the festival cycle? Because the events that take place occur during various Jewish festivals. The Festival of Booths. And it ends just before the festival of Passover. And then the last section of the Book of Signs, before this transition period, is known as the Lazarus cycle. It begins, I'm just going to say chapter 11, but also at the beginning of chapter 12. It begins with Lazarus being sick. He dies. He's buried. Jesus shows up, raises him from the dead. Jesus goes for a little while, comes back to Bethany, getting ready for the Passover, the triumphal entry, chapter 12. And he goes back to the home of whom? Lazarus. And everybody is celebrating Lazarus. They're going to have a feast in celebration of Lazarus. And there is almost universal acclamation that if Lazarus was once dead and now he's alive, we ought to get together and party. Right? But it's not all unanimous. Because in chapter 12, we read these remarkable statements that the Jewish leadership wanted not only to kill Jesus, but they wanted to kill Lazarus. And that leads to the transition of chapter 12. So I want you to imagine for a moment that you're a brand new Christian, never read the Bible in your life, and you start with the Gospel of John because your spiritual father or mother in the faith said, this is where you ought to start reading. So you've started reading, and you're just fascinated by this, right? And throughout this book of signs, both in Canaan, the festivals, and of course with the raising of Lazarus, Jesus is doing remarkable things. I mean, incredible things. Seven signs. Okay? And then you get to the end of chapter 11 and the beginning of chapter 12, and not only are these Jewish people not believing in Jesus, some of them are absolutely antagonistic toward him. And they want to kill him. And you're a brand new Christian, and you're reading this, and you're scratching your head, and you're going, how in the world is it possible that all of these people see these remarkable signs? They know they're true. And rather than believing in Jesus, they continue in their disbelief, and they become thoroughly antagonistic and hateful toward him. How is that possible? John knows that's what you're going to think. And so he spends time in chapter 12 answering that question. How can Jesus do all of these things before these people and they're met with disbelief? How is that possible? Chapter 12 answers the question. We'll look at it in detail a little later. Chapter 12, as a transition, helps to answer that question looking backward, while I mentioned a moment ago, anticipating the issue of that comes to the forefront in the book of Glory and Exaltation and the cross. And it happens because Greeks show up and say, we'd like to speak to Jesus. And Jesus says, this is an indication that my time is near. It's at hand. Remember, a number of times earlier in his ministry, he runs from it because his time had not yet come. He escapes when they want to make him a king, because he knows his time's not here. But now in chapter 12, the Greeks show up. They say, we want to talk to Jesus. And Jesus says, this is a sign that now my time is here. So he prays in chapter 12. He says, Father, I have glorified you before these that you've given me. Now glorify me. And the Father responds. This is the third time in Jesus' ministry. It happens at his baptism. It happens on the Mount of Transfiguration, and now it happens for the third time. For the third time, the Father speaks audibly from heaven and says, I have glorified it, and I will glorify it again. That's why the next part of the book is called the Book of. It is the Father glorifying the Son through his obedient willingness to die on that cross, and then to be raised gloriously from the grave. The Book of Glory is about the cross and the resurrection, and it goes very, very slowly. Okay, sections in the Book of Glory. There's the Upper Room Discourse, which if you've been in the church for a couple of years, you should be very familiar with. So we got the Upper Room Discourse. It's called the Upper Room Discourse. Why? He was discoursing in the upper room. That's exactly right. Okay. So that's 13 through 16. Okay. He's getting his disciples ready for his going away. And he says, look, this is going to be hard. But when I go away, understand I'm not leaving you as orphans. I'm going to send another one who is like me to you. And when he, the Spirit of truth, comes, he will guide you into all of this truth. He will be with you and in you. Okay, the upper room discourse. Secondly, you've got the high priestly prayer. Chapter 17. And the dominant theme of the high priestly prayer is glory. Glory. Father, I pray that these whom you have given me will be with me where I have been from beginning to the foundation of the world and may see the glory that I have had with you. So when you show up in heaven one day and you get to witness that glory, it's because the Father answered the prayer of the Lord there in that high priestly prayer. Then you have, of course, his passion, his arrest, his trial, his beatings, and ultimately his crucifixion, right? So you got the passion narrative. Okay? And then what? The resurrection and post-resurrection appearances. Okay, that's in 20. And then the epilogue in 21. Let's talk a little bit about John and the Synoptics. There are common elements between the Synoptics. There are common elements in the Synoptics that are not in John. So if you read John, you're not going to read about the virgin birth. You won't read about the Sermon on the Mount. There's no Lord's Prayer, which is part of the Sermon on the Mount. The dominant phrase in the Synoptics is the kingdom of God. It occurs over and over and over and over again throughout the Synoptics. All the parables that Jesus teaches. And by the way, there are no parables in John. The parables are all in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. But all the parables are this. The kingdom of heaven, or the kingdom of God, is like, that's the way they all get introduced, right? Jesus talks about the kingdom all the time. The Synoptics are about the rule and reign of Jesus. John, I think the term kingdom only occurs two times in the Gospel of John, and one of them occurs in the mouth of Pilate. Are you a king? And Jesus says, my kingdom is not of this world, right? That's about the only time in John the phrase kingdom comes up. I mentioned the parables, exorcisms. Exorcisms play a very important role in the Synoptics. Why? Exactly. It is the coming of God's kingdom against the kingdom of Satan. And so this clash of power and rule that goes on in his ministry, Matthew, Mark, and Luke talk a lot about it. John doesn't say anything about it. How about the Olivet Discourse? We've talked a lot about the Olivet Discourse recently. I'll talk about it again Sunday. The Olivet Discourse is in the Synoptics, especially Matthew and Mark. It's not in the Gospel of John. Now, just a word here. This doesn't mean that John wasn't present for all of those things. He saw them all. He was a witness to them all. Why doesn't he talk about them? Well, in part because you got three books that already have. John was the last of the Gospels written, probably. So you've got three books that have already been written. And at the end of the Gospel of John, John says this: many other things Jesus did. And I suppose if we wrote them, there aren't enough books in all the world to contain those things, right? He's being very selective, as the Synoptics were very selective. He's not contradicting them. He's complimenting them. So if Nanette wrote a history of the last 40 years of the church, and she tried to keep it to 10 pages or less, there would be a lot of things she'd have to leave out. And if she handed it to me and said, Tony, would you read this I read it and say, you know, you mind if I write my own history of it? I'm not going to just write what she wrote. I'm going to write some of the things that she didn't include. And when we're all done, we still would only have just a fraction of what has taken place in this church over the past 40 years. Just a tiny bit. And that's what John is saying. John's not contradicting Matthew, Mark, and Luke. He's adding his testimony to it and putting in what they didn't include. But even at that, gets to the end of it, he says, there are enough books in this world to tell you everything that we saw, everything that we heard. Just know that what I'm writing is true. It's true, and so it should be believed. Here's some unique things in the Gospel of John that are not in the Synoptics. The seven miraculous signs. The seven I am sayings. Think seven is an important word number? Kind of. The high priestly prayer. How about these characters? Nicodemus, the Samaritan woman, the man who's lame for 37 years, the man who's born blind from birth, Lazarus. Matthew, Mark, and Luke don't tell us about any of those characters. We wouldn't know anything about them if we didn't have this fourth gospel. Think it's important? I think it's really important. We wouldn't have discourses like the bread of life, the good shepherd, or the farewell discourse. Matthew, Mark, and Luke don't give us any of those things. John does. John is the complementary gospel. The synoptics emphasize the authority of Jesus. So John, when he's talking about the miracles, uses the word sign. When the gospel, the synoptics, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, talk about his miracles, they use a completely different word. It's his dunamis, his power, his powerful workings, the miracles. That's what they are. Jesus, or John, is saying these signs, these miracles testified to Jesus' person. The synoptics are saying these miracles testified to Jesus' power. Which is right. They both are. They're both things. They are a sign and an evidence of his power. Why would the synoptics emphasize his power? Because they're emphasizing the coming of the kingdom. And do you want a king that is powerful or impotent? Do you want a king who pushes back the realm of darkness or is pushed back himself? Do you want a king whose kingdom the gates of hell can't stop? That's what the synoptics are saying. It's all about his kingdom, his reign, his power, his rule. John is about his eternal person made flesh among us. The synoptics are all about authority over demons, nature, and disease, and giving that authority to us, the Great Commission. All authority in heaven and on earth is whose? Jesus. Therefore, you go and make disciples of the nations, teaching them to observe all that I have commanded you. So it is in his authority that we go forth and make war with Satan and his dominion, pushing it back through the preaching and proclamation of the gospel. That's how it's pushed back. John answers the question, who is Jesus of the synoptics? Who is he? And what he says is, if you've read Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and you've come to understand all of his work and his power and his authority, let me add some more color to that. Let me tell you who you're looking at. He is the one who in the beginning, and in the beginning is a phrase that evokes what? Genesis 1:1, who in the beginning was the Word, he was with God, and he was God. And that Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. That's what the Gospel of John is all about. So we have done a 30,000-foot flyover of the book. Next time, we start getting a shovel out and digging deep. Okay? So you've flown over, hopefully at this point now, between now and next 2 weeks from now, you can read the Gospel of John with this outline in mind, with these themes in mind, and be prepared as we kind of dig in here to the prologue. Okay? Any questions? Yes. Probably toward the end of the first century. Maybe similar time to his epistles and Revelation. After 70 AD, I think. Yeah. There is no mention of the destruction of Jerusalem in any of the New Testament writings, which is pretty remarkable. I think that's probably because most of them were written before it, and John doesn't mention it, but I think it was probably written afterwards. That's kind of the consensus. Yeah. There is a biblical scholar who believes that since the temple was not mentioned, its destruction was not mentioned in any of the New Testament writings, that all of the New Testament writings were written before 70 AD, because something that cataclysmic would have made its way into the writings. But the consensus is that John's probably written later. I think Hebrews is written just before, when he says that the old covenant is growing old and obsolete and is soon to pass away. The temple sacrifices were going to be over. They're going to be done. Okay, anything else? Yeah, you'll have handouts each time. And see how there are holes that are punched in the handouts? That's not to make the trash lighter when you throw the notes away. It's to put it in a notebook and keep it, as I'm sure you have over all these years that I've been doing these theology sessions. He says, knowing that that's not true. Yeah, so we streamed it tonight. So will it be recorded also, John? We know it's going to be recorded audio. Will the video be recorded? Okay, so it'll be on Facebook. And we'll do this every night as long as John's here to do it for us. Okay, yeah. So we'll do it. All right, thanks, everybody.